From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. Why don't you subscribe to it today? This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much. You're helping put this show on the air. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Around the country, there are hundreds of, for example, crosses like these or Ten Commandments monuments. And people who are not of a particular faith or atheists really do feel it excludes them. The decision today basically says we're going to put an end to all of these fights about old monuments. This one having been around, as you say, almost 100 years. Justice Alito and a majority of the court say those now really are understood to be essentially monuments to valor. They're not about religion. We're going to let them be.
A challenging issue the Supreme Court decided during the course of the just ended term involved a longstanding, enormous cross in Maryland. What the ruling reveals about the court's thinking on religious issues and how they may play out in upcoming cases are questions I'll pose to attorney Rabbi Jay Michelson.
I came to realize that there was nothing in the Quran that prevented someone who was homosexual from being Muslim. So I was not an oxymoron. Oh my goodness. So I found out that it was not the Quran that people often say, well, it's in the Quran in that particular verse they did so and so and so. That's not true. Where did it come from? From the interpreters of the Quran. They brought their own biases in against homosexuality and wrote it in their translations. But when you read the Arabic, it doesn't say that.
A number of religious traditions are wrestling with questions of inclusivity and respect for LGBTQ persons of faith. It's a particularly challenging issue for Muslims. And on the cutting edge is one of the only openly gay imams in the world, Daya Abdullah. But first,
the best hour every week. It's Wednesday morning first thing, because that's the hour of the Senate prayer breakfast. It's when two dozen senators, conservative and evangelical, Mormon and Protestant, Jewish and even Buddhist, gather together for an hour, and we do two things that don't exist in the rest of our weeks. We trust each other, and we listen.
That's Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons, who co-chairs a weekly prayer breakfast on the Hill, widely recognized as one of the few current gatherings that foster true bipartisanship in Washington. While many of our listeners won't find any contradiction between an active, engaged faith and respect for the diverse beliefs of everyone, the narrative that has been endlessly promoted by the political religious right and endlessly amplified by a compliant media pits one against the other. It sets up inclusive, progressive values as the natural opposite of fervent belief to the detriment of both. This week, the Delaware senator outlined this dilemma and suggested some prescriptions for change in an outstanding article for The Atlantic magazine. And I am thrilled that it brings him back to State of Belief Radio. Senator Coons, thanks so much for taking this time to be with us.
I'm happy to.
In your article in The Atlantic, headline Democrats Need to Talk About Their Faith, addresses the reasons religion has long been downplayed as inspiring progressive political positions. I'd love to hear you say something about those reasons.
Well, thanks for a chance to be with you today, Reverend Getty. I think that Democrats don't share with voters, with their communities, their own faith values and experiences for two reasons. First, out of a well-justified concern about the separation of church and state, a reticence to be seen to be injecting religious values or principles into public discourse. And I do think it's important for those of us who are elected to always conduct ourselves in a way that makes it clear we respect and we represent and we honor those of many faiths and those of no faith. But I also think it's the result of Democrats recoiling from what they've seen since the 1980s, really, where a combination of conservative political ideas and theologically conservative ideas by the moral majority and many others seemed to turn faith into something that was used more for political ends than for spiritual or personal or social ends. And many Democrats have withdrawn from engaging in the public sphere in ways that talk about their own hearts and their own priorities and their own values as a result.
Several years ago, the DNC asked me to speak to their state leaders about how to use religious language on the campaign trail. I tried to emphasize that a person on the campaign trail needs to speak naturally about who the person is, confessionally, truthful, but not in terms that a candidate has to fake and uncomfortably speak about. How do you tell people they should talk about religion on the campaign trail?
Well, Reverend Getty, I'll just agree with you that it doesn't matter what you're talking about on the campaign trail, whether it's your positions on education and health care, or it's your concerns about national security and the deficit, or it's your own life experience and how the values you were raised with or the faith that you've developed inform your service. Be authentic. Show people who you really are, and talk about your priorities and your values in a way that is something that's accessible for your audience.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say as well. And what I was getting at is there are people who don't feel comfortable speaking about their faith.
Well, then they shouldn't. I mean, you know, for colleagues who don't find it a comfortable thing to do to talk about their faith or their values, then they shouldn't. This isn't something I'm urging people to take on as an electoral strategy or to adopt if it is inauthentic or uncomfortable.
Senator Coons, there is a record number of Muslims in Congress this term. The number of atheists elected to federal office is tiny but also growing. I want to ask you this. Getting to know people who are different from us is the one sure way most people lose their biases and prejudices. What are the chances of that happening in Congress?
Well, Reverend, we have a real challenge these days in Congress, getting to know each other simply because of a number of things that have developed in recent years. The availability of cheap jet travel and the expectation that members will go home to their districts every weekend have frayed what had for a long time been one of the simple ways that members get to know each other, which is by living here and raising their families here in Washington. Second is the constant demands of fundraising and, you know, frankly, the development of an incredibly varied array of media outlets, whether it's podcasts or social media or digital production. It used to be that the news ran once a day, and in a congressman's or a senator's home district or state, there might be a handful of newspapers and television outlets, and now there's hundreds, if not thousands. So there are a variety of ways in which the interpersonal, human, and authentic relationships between senators and congressmen have gotten harder and more challenging recently. And those pressures are no less real in terms of the ability to get to know each other in terms of our faiths and our faith differences and our backgrounds. So, you know, look, you have to be willing to open your heart and to meet with and listen to people of other faiths or of no faith, and you either are or aren't going to make that a priority. I think that's an important and often successful way to build bipartisan relationships that may then lead to successful legislating. But it certainly isn't going to get better if you don't make the effort.
Let me ask you a question for your counsel. Washington has become so cynical, in a sense that so many Americans have become cynical about Washington, reclaiming the faith and faith-inspired values so many of us are living out every day could go a long way toward changing that. What is your charge to each of us about that?
My encouragement would be to ask folks who are listening to reach out to your member of Congress and encourage them to take the time to get to know someone of a different faith or a different background. Encourage them to share more openly and authentically about the values that drew them, called them into public service. And I'll frankly say I encourage your listeners to be optimistic about what is possible here. Because frankly, pessimism, cynicism about Congress and about our representative democracy has become in some ways a self-fulfilling prophecy. When folks are angry about what happens in Washington and are willing to vote for any change, some of the results we've gotten are that folks get sent to Washington who are more interested in burning the institution down or changing it so profoundly that it has become dysfunctional, rather than sending people to Washington who are willing to compromise, willing to work across the aisle, and willing to solve the problems that face real people's lives.
One last question. Toward the end of your article, you invoke a wonderful Christian maxim: preach the gospel at all times. When necessary, use words. What does that command mean to you?
Act authentically, act faithfully, and only talk about it when absolutely necessary.
Senator Chris Coons, the Atlantic article is headlined, "Democrats Need to Talk About Their Faith," and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. I urge our listeners to read it carefully. Senator Coons, I can't thank you enough for your efforts on these essential matters and for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I enjoyed being on.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll get a Supreme Court summary from Jay Michelson and later openly gay Imam Dalia Abdullah. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. It was the most directly religion-oriented decision of the latest Supreme Court term. The giant cross in Bladensburg, Maryland, that has stood for decades on public land. I'm joined once again by attorney and activist Rabbi Jay Michelson. Jay, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Jay, you were with us when this decision first came down. It certainly wasn't the most shocking decision at the time, and you said the ruling was decidedly expected. Now, looking at it in the context of the rest of the term, does it take on any additional significance?
I think so. I think, you know, this was a middle-of-the-road decision. It left the cross in place, but said that the age of the memorial counts a lot and definitely suggested that you couldn't put up a new memorial that would look just like this one. And I think, you know, as we've seen, it's been a really mixed set of results this year from the Supreme Court. The census case, obviously, was a big victory for progressives, but the voting rights cases were big victories for conservatives. And, you know, I think the cross case sits right in the middle of those, where it was kind of splitting the difference.
Jay, what other decisions did the court hand down that concretely or potentially reveal the majority understanding of the bedrock principle of religious liberty?
Well, I think, you know, to me, I think the cross case is really the primary religion case this year. And I think what we're going to be seeing in the coming year actually are going to be more developments on that. And on the question of religious liberty, you know, the court actually kind of punted on a new version of Masterpiece Cake Shop. We'll be looking at it in the fall, but they didn't take action on it right now. And I think both sides, in a strange way, were emboldened by the Cross case result. So on the one hand, this looks great if you have a conservative view of religious liberty because the Cross is staying in place and it should be maintained by taxpayer dollars. On the other hand, some of the language in the court opinions gave some courage to progressives who want a little bit more separation of church and state. So I think, you know, we're going to see some of the flashpoints arise in the next year or so, but none more importantly than abortion. I mean, we've seen now a number of laws passed in conservative states, or states with conservative legislatures, I should say, directly challenging Roe versus Wade. And there were a number of cases that allowed the justices to talk about precedent and the importance of precedent, how you can overturn it, when you can overturn it. And in the background of all of those are the abortion cases, whichever one eventually makes its way up to the Supreme Court. And that will take a little while to happen.
I'm curious as to what you think about the cases that the justices declined to take up. And I'm really curious as to whether or not that tells us something important about the majority's thinking.
I'm going to say it doesn't. I'm not sure that's the most exciting answer. But, you know, there is in our business, there's a lot of reading of tea leaves. And having worked as a clerk for Judge Merrick Garland on the D.C. Circuit, you know, I can tell you there's a million reasons why judges do and don't do certain things. And at the Supreme Court level, it's really, I think it's kind of a fool's errand to try to see, well, you know, because these are often unsigned orders that don't have any rationale or explanation. It could be entirely procedural in nature. It could be substantive in nature. So we really don't know. I think it's wiser to look at when the justices do say something than when they don't.
Looking at a lot of important columns you've written recently as legal affairs columnist for the Daily Beast, one considered some positions taken by Chief Justice Roberts that could impact challenges to Roe v. Wade in the near future. I'd like for you to talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So, you know, from a legal Supreme Court point of view, a lot of the question about Roe versus Wade is about precedent and respect for precedent. The Supreme Court doctrine of stare decisis, which means the decision stands. A number of justices have sort of weighed in. Justice Thomas, I think most on the extreme side, set up a test for stare decisis that just means you don't have to respect any precedent. I mean, it basically says if the original opinion wasn't good enough, you can overturn it. And of course, who decides that? It's the justice writing the opinion deciding to overturn it. So it's kind of a bit of circular reasoning. And that's not surprising. Justice Thomas just doesn't have a very sophisticated jurisprudence, and he never has. So that's not particularly surprising. There was an obscure case, obscure for some folks, important for law nerds like me on administrative law, which had to do with when courts defer to agency decisions. And without getting into any of the weeds, one of the issues in that case was looking at a precedent, which set forth a certain standard of review. And there, Justice Roberts actually took a much more robust view of stare decisis, of respect for precedent, certainly than Justice Thomas did. And he ended up leaving the earlier doctrine in place, which was, I guess, a substantive victory more for the progressive side. But, you know, Justice Roberts wasn't doing the politics. He was doing the law. And that, I think, was a really interesting moment. It was a case where you might expect Chief Justice Roberts to have disagreed on the substance of that particular question. But because of process, he left the existing law in place. And that, I think, again, that's not quite reading tea leaves. I mean, that's signaling how the Chief Justice of the United States regards problematic precedents. So the new crop of abortion cases will be much more forthright in challenging Roe versus Wade. Justice Kavanaugh wrote when he was a judge and a professor before that Roe versus Wade was part of a whole series of judicial activism that should be that he didn't respect. So I think we know where his vote is. We probably know where Justice Gorsuch's vote is, but we don't know where the Chief Justice is. And he has emerged, to the dismay of folks on the left, because he is still a very conservative justice, he's emerged as the swing vote.
Well, Jay, as we look at the summer months when they're off and anticipate what's coming in the fall, what will be the most important things to look for in the next session of the Supreme Court?
Well, there's some really important cases on gun rights and gun control that the court has taken. They'll be looking at that in the fall. I would be paying a lot of attention to the abortion cases working their way through the lower court system. And not to switch constitutional crises, but there are also a number of cases on the border wall, which are stalled. I think there's now half a dozen separate lawsuits that are moving through the courts. The lawsuits aren't stalled, the border wall is stalled. You may remember that our president also declared a national emergency to take money that Congress had deliberately decided not to spend. Right. This is another very similar case. If you look at it, Congress said, no, we are not going to spend money on this border wall. And the president said, well, we're going to find the money and do it ourselves. So in a way, it starts to look very similar to the census case where Congress decided, no, we're not going to add a citizenship question. The court said, no, the agency is not allowed to do it on their own. And now the president thinks that he's the dictator. So both for the substantive reasons of the border wall itself and also as yet another test. The border wall cases will be one to watch. And I'll just say, I think after the travel ban case, you and I spoke a year ago,
right?
And I found that to be a really disappointing decision, because what Chief Justice Roberts, again, writing for the court, basically did was he took the Trump administration at its word. You know, they came up with some reasons for the travel ban, and Chief Justice Roberts said, well, that's good enough. And he said, yeah, it's true that the president called this a Muslim ban, and that wouldn't be constitutional, but we're just not going to look at that. We're not going to peek behind the curtain. And the census case was really the opposite of that. He actually did peek behind the curtain. And there are many reasons we could all guess. Linda Greenhouse had a great article about this in the New York Times, why the census but not the travel ban, basically. But I think, the record was just so appalling in the census case that it just, there was a line, and Chief Justice Roberts said, beyond that line, you just can't lie this much and this overtly and get caught doing it. And we'll see which Chief Justice Roberts shows up in the border wall case.
So, Jay, I just have to ask you before we get off, as you look at this next session of the court, do you look at it optimistically or with some fear?
That's a good question. It's not one of the ones I prepared to answer for today. I think I've come to really understand the justices a lot more this term. For example, Justice Gorsuch, who we haven't talked about a lot, with a new justice, you don't really know what you're going to get. And we're getting a sense from him. He's very, in a certain way, he's idiosyncratic. He voted with the liberal justices a number of times. But if you actually look closely at his opinions, he's a small government guy. There are a lot of different kinds of conservatives out there. One conservative is a law and order conservative, which tends to favor state government if it's on the side of the military or the police or so forth. But another kind of conservative is a small government conservative. And that's Justice Gorsuch's kind. He's kind of a civil libertarian sometimes, and he just does not like big government. That could be interesting for how you might vote on the border wall case, where the government is massively expanding its power in direct opposition to Congress. I actually think he'd be likely to vote against the Trump border wall. Hmm. So that's interesting, and I think it's now very well known. I'm not saying anything new. That Chief Justice Roberts is what lawyers call an institutionalist, meaning he's very interested in preserving the institution of the Supreme Court. And the court's legitimacy. And I think he's gone some way toward doing that. Certainly, liberals were very unhappy with his decisions in the gerrymandering cases. He just kind of opened the door to unlimited partisan gerrymandering. But there again, that was consistent with his philosophy. Those cases are hard to decide. it's hard to say when a, you know, a bogus congressional district is too bogus. Like, how partisan is too partisan? That's a tough question to answer. And so even though I also was very disturbed by those particular opinions on his part, it is consistent with his philosophy. So I think, is that optimism? I think I can understand how he might come down on different cases. And I should add, we didn't mention it before, but there's also been a decision on Obamacare from the Fifth Circuit that will almost certainly go to the Supreme Court. So for the third time, the court will be asked to look at the legality and constitutionality of Obamacare. That's another, obviously, top ticket item. So I think I'm cautiously optimistic, but certainly it depends what you mean by optimism. If your optimism is tied to, let's say, a liberal or conservative set of results, then no, we should not be optimistic one way or the other. But I think after the census case in particular, if your optimism is about a more fundamental question, which is the Supreme Court preserving the rule of law in this country at a time at which it's been threatened like never before? I can't think of any time in the history of the country that the rule of law and the constitutional order has been threatened as it is right now. And there, the Supreme Court is stepping up. And so that's a more profound optimism that maybe goes even a little bit deeper than the usual ideological divide.
Dr. J. Michelson is an attorney, author, and activist, as well as a rabbi and meditation teacher. His books include the best-selling God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and my favorite, The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. He is also the prolific legal affairs columnist for The Daily Beast. Jay, as always, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, Walton. Hope you're well and have a great summer.
Online communities of LGBTQ Muslims and allies are not difficult to find these days. Real life support, however, is far more difficult to locate. But it's not impossible, and one of the leaders who make that possible is Imam Dayo Abdullah. Delighted to be able to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Imam Abdullah, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Reverend Gaddy, and I'm happy to be here.
You were raised Baptist and converted to Islam at age 30. Can I start by asking how that came about?
Well, it was a step-by-step process. Though both of my parents were Baptists, they're Southern Baptists, actually, there in Detroit, where I grew up. At the age of 8, I realized that there was something there that wasn't quite sitting well within me, within my spiritual self. And so I spoke with them and asked them about studying other religions to learn more about the expanse and the breadth of faith. And them being educated people, they agreed. And so being in Detroit, because of the auto industry, people came there from all over the world. I was exposed to a wide array of different religious beliefs, from Judaism to even Buddhism, because one of my elementary friends growing up, his father was black and mother was Korean. They married coming from the Korean War. So I was exposed to a wide array of different religious beliefs that were there. And eventually, as I was coming out of high school, I got involved in metaphysics. And then from there, I eventually did some study in Buddhism and also other aspects of the Hindu faith. And then at the age of 30, I was in China, and it was there at Beijing University that I was introduced to Islam through some of my Hui, which are the ethnic Chinese Muslims, that introduced me to Islam there.
I was going to ask you which came first, the spiritual awakening in you or coming to terms with your sexuality, but I am assuming that your exploration in spirituality came first and then dealing with sexuality came second?
Well, actually, it was around the same time. I knew that as a very young child, around 5 years old, that I was uniquely different from the other boys that I knew. Mm-hmm. And therefore, my difference was not that I didn't play baseball and football and ride bikes and do all those things together, but I just knew that there was something about me that was different than what the other boys understood about their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I didn't explore, but as I grew older, that was something that did come out. So I think that both of them happened around the same time in terms of my spiritual development, as well as my understanding of myself as being a person who was a boy who liked other boys.
Mm-hmm. So how did the spirituality that you had experienced relate to the sexuality that you were identifying?
Well, that's... to put it in a way I think most people would be able to understand, as I entered high school, I wound up going to high school at 12 because I would go to summer school every year. So I wound up entering high school 3 years early and graduating at 15. That the exploration of teenage love was one of the ways in which it developed. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way in which it grew in terms of my understanding myself as a teenager, but also in my educational process of understanding spirituality. I knew there was great diversity there in the world in terms of spirit and religion. And then I also saw that same thing manifest in me in terms of sexual orientation.
I see. How did you move into religious leadership?
Well, that came in somewhat of a different way. After I had finished college, you know, my studies overseas and had come back, done law school and had practiced law for a little while, and then went back to the Middle East for some more graduate study. It was back in the U.S., back in the early 2000s, that I received an email from someone, an anonymous person, who said that there was a young Muslim man who had died of HIV who was in the morgue, and no one had claimed his body. And would I be willing to do his janazah or funeral prayer mm-hmm. for him? And I'd always believed from my early beginnings, because both my parents were civil rights advocates as well, that I believed that every human being had the right, R-I-G-H-T, for their religious rights, R-I-T-E-S. Mm-hmm. And so I agreed to go and do it. I called the morgue, went down and performed the religious prayer and did the shrouding. And I didn't have the money to actually do a funeral for him, but I was able to do those services. And I felt that was the way. And when people heard about that, they took on that's when I got the title of Imam, when actually I was studying to become a sheikh, more of a scholar in Islam.
Hmm.
But then I realized the LGBTQ Muslim community needed someone as a leader, so I accepted that role.
I know that your early ministry was focused on serving those who were rejected by organized religion, whether they were Muslim or followers of other Abrahamic religions. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Okay. One of the things that was consistent, and I based it on lack of education. Within the Islamic faith, the education is based on a particular narrowly defined and prescribed understanding of what sexual diversity means within the Islamic concept, as much as it is like in Christianity and Judaism to a certain extent, that the people needed someone to talk to. And I've always believed that it's important to listen to people and understand them, and then to also convey some of my own personal life experiences to them so that there's a connection between us. It's almost like the way in which if you can get someone to a sense of humor, that it's easier for them to connect with you as a person. So I did the same type of thing. And once we were able to connect, my words meant more to them because they felt that I was listening to them and understanding the turmoil, the trauma, and the difficulties that they were facing. And my own personal experiences were able to guide them in a way to help them bridge the gap, so to speak, from where they were to understanding that life can get better, and give them the types of tools and or guidelines to help them make that progression.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I had a couple of teenagers or young adults who were talking about how they had had problems or they had friends who committed suicide. Well, I was able to tell them about my teenage love, my first love, Otis, who had committed suicide in my senior year of high school. And so it was people were able to connect because I had an experience and then they could understand. And so that helped me understand that these are some of the same problems that young adults, young people and young adults experience, and that I was able to survive it. And these were the tools I used to help me do that. And I was always able to connect.
Many religions have softened their stance on LGBTQ persons in the past 20 years. How have these changes affected Muslims in your own work?
Well, I think that although I was one of the earlier ones out there in terms of dealing with LGBTQ religious issues, I think it gave a lot of people encouragement to understand that we do exist. And for those individuals who followed the more traditional line that although we may exist, we were not within the guidelines, within the framework of the Muslim community, the re-education process has been very, very important. And being part of that, because we have a number of scholars today who over the last two decades have come out themselves, but also helped in the scholarly research that is there. But I think that I played a more important role in understanding how Islamic law works within society, or how law works within the society, and how people generally will adjust their life and how they live their lives in public through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how that has been a major change, because in my, thankfully, I have a scholarship, but also the ability to translate the academic scholarship into layman terms. And so I think that's where the real strength has happened, and that's why there's been a monumental move. And when I say monumental, meaning that for the younger the people are, Muslims are, the more open they are to the LGBT community, not just because of me, but also because of the change in how LGBT people are being understood in Western society.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, and you've already addressed this to a certain extent, but I want to go up a little further with it. Across your years, what has been the biggest challenge that you faced in your work?
I think the biggest challenge, which I think is just part of being outsiders, I mean, the LGBTQ community are outsiders of the mainstream society, is the issue of self-acceptance and the process of then finding that, building that inner strength to be able to deal with those particular issues. Now, my parents were very supportive of me. When I came out of high school, I told them that I was gay, and we had that conversation, which I think many gay people have had with their parents. But my parents were very extremely supportive, and they told me, you have upheld all the standards that we have for your brothers and sister, and you know, there's nothing wrong with you. And it helped me, that gave me an opportunity to bridge, to help them better understand them having a gay child, but also that the things that they taught me, that they could depend on me standing up and having the standards that they could be proud of, no matter what my sexual orientation.
Oh, you had great parents. Can you think of one experience, or if you want to do two, fine, of a story that would illuminate the journey that you've been on all these years?
Well, There are a couple of them. Let's see, which ones would I want to convey?
Say them both.
Okay. Well, one of them has been in the last 2 decades or so in terms of being able to talk with people and get them to understand that we all have a lot of things in common. And we do not have to just rely upon what people tell us, but that we must take the steps forward in order to educate ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it's not really a story per se, but it's one of the mantras that I try to import for people so that I sit down with them and talk about those particular verses and how those verses can be interpreted one way, but if you look at it from a different perspective, those other perspectives, alternative views, have as much validity in terms of understanding what the Quranic message means.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps people to move beyond the fallacies that are often projected onto people, you know, the bandwagon fallacy. Everybody believes a certain way, so you should believe that way as well. And then one of the others that I think was rather the sort of anecdotal, in a way, when I was living in Saudi Arabia in the late 90s, I had a conversation with a gentleman. I'm naturally left-handed, mm-hmm. and there, in that particular culture, being right-handed is the preferred way in which you interact, particularly when you eat. And I had a conversation with the gentleman, and he was like, well, you should do like the prophet, because the prophet was right-handed. And I told him, I said, well, although that may be true, I'm not going to mimic or ape the practices of the prophet in order to make other people comfortable when I am naturally left-handed. And that is my right, quote-unquote, right hand to use. And then the general at the Air Force base that I was teaching at, he says, Dai, come over here and talk with me. And he said to me, he says, you have to understand that sometimes people have not had exposure to things. And because of that, they believe a certain way. But you, like me, we've lived in other parts of the world, we've traveled, things of this nature, that it's important that we not take what people say so heavily, because it can influence how we practice our faith. Hmm. So those are words of wisdom that helped me quite a bit. And later, Dr. Taha Jabralawani, who was my mentor in the early 2000s, he also reiterated that. He says that, Dai, when you're talking to people, talk to them at the level they understand. Although you could tell them great scholarly things, he says, talk to them as, you know, John and Jane Q. Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And you'll get better responses to them than to stand up and pontificate, where they won't understand what you're saying and they leave more confused than when they came.
Hmm. Great stories. Imam, this is, I don't have to tell you this. This is a tumultuous world. There are a lot of things going ways that we don't want them to go. What gives you hope?
Well, I think that there are many things that give me hope. One of them is that I see the brightness and the sparkle in younger people's eyes. And as much as I encourage them to keep thinking forward, keep thinking to achieve things there, I also caution them not to be too overly optimistic. As the adage goes in the Muslim community is that trust everybody but still tie your camel.
Hmm.
And so I encourage them to be very open-minded, continue to work with people, but also don't lose yourself completely in the activism. Because if you do, you could find yourself years later poor and disenfranchised because of your activity, and the very people that you may have helped will not be there to support you. So I try to get them to see that we live in a world that's important, and we must make changes for to make life better. But also, we have bills to pay, and you may get sick, so you have to take care of yourself and have life insurance and those kinds of things. And that way, you're putting that protection. That's tying your horse, tying your camel, as you continue to trust people and work to make improved lives for a lot of people.
And Mom, tell me about the masjid in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to have you pronounce it because I respect it and I don't want to say it the wrong way.
Well, it's Masjid al-Nur, and actually I closed the masjid down a few years ago. One of the problems was that people were fearful to come to the mosque, and though people would come, meaning that I did it for well over 4 years, almost 5 years of practice. One of the problems was that I could not get people to commit so that the masjid would be there whether I was alive or not, or available or not to be there. And I couldn't get that kind of commitment. And I think part of it was fear. I think part of it was there was no real community that had developed and coalesced that allowed that to come about. But now that we have other masjids in other parts of the country, well, in Canada and a few other parts of the U.S., where people have been able to do that, build a community, we do have examples of that, but they're still very few. And one of the things that I think is very important is that people, when they come to these places, they have to be willing to give, too. And what I mean by that is, if you're able to come to the masjid and then one Friday out of every 2 months come and help volunteer, help set up, help, you know, with the different events. If we have like an iftar or something going on, help stay around to help clean up, those kinds of things. Because the burden that put on me over those 4 years, I grew tired too. And so I think that it's just as important, no matter what type of faith that you, the religion you follow, the community building part is always important, and people have to volunteer because in masjids, in many places, they're supported with funding. But mine, we didn't have any funding. So it's important that people volunteer to make up for that, because that's just those few hours, every month or so, that makes the difference in making certain that other people who come who are in need for community will be able to come there and find it.
I know you've worked with Muslims for Progressive Values as executive director of the Mecca Institute. I have one last question for you, and it's a big one. What one universal message would you like to share that applies to LGBTQ persons of faith, regardless of their particular religion?
Well, I think that one of the things that we have to remind the LGBT community overall is that our parents brought us into this world, and out of that responsibility to our parents is that we have to be truthful with them in the best way that we can. It's not that we are to, you know, commit in such a way that if you're a teenager and your parents are in the community, and if they find out that that their child is gay, it can influence how the family's life can be influenced in the negative, that we have to weigh the balance of those things. But it's so important that we recognize, the parents recognize, that no matter what their religious background, they are the parent and they have certain responsibilities to the child. And in reverse, the child has to the parent. And if they really sit down and talk about these things and try to have a better understanding between them, they don't have to agree in the end, but at least they better understand the reasonings and the emphasis that they have, where their heart is at, where their love is at, and how they want to do right by their parents. And the parents should also take the opposite position, that they want to do right by their children. I think they find a much better position where they can still have the dance of parent and child and still be able to find that love between them that's so important, which I found in my relationship with my parents, and I saw with other people who had good relationships with their parents too, and that makes all the difference in the world. I would encourage people to look up Mecca Institute, because our goal is to help re-educate the Muslim community to better understand their Islamic history and how their faith has been influenced through that history. And I think once they are able to better understand that, that they will see Islam in a new light.
As one of only a handful of openly gay imams in the world, Imam Abdullah has been an inspiration to many and a source of controversy for others. But the passion and wisdom he brings to his ministry should be clear from our short conversation. Imam Abdullah, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
You're welcome, and thank you.
This conversation is part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion. Whosoever You Love is supported by the Arcus Foundation, which is dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and find the entire series at www.whosoeveryou.love. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you so much. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.